Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning. So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning right here on WLIW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at WLIW.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. Each show is archived on my website at annliguori.com, that's A-N-N-L-I-G-U-O-R-I.com, and distributed on my podcast via Audio Boom and iTunes. This morning, I'm going to share a conversation I had with legendary golfer Bernhard Langer. Bernhard is soon to be 66 years of age, and he recently became the winningest player on the PGA Tour Champions, 50 and older tour. Winning the U.S. Senior Open in Wisconsin in July became his 46th win on this 50 and older circuit, breaking Hale Irwin's record of 45 wins. Langer has won a record 12 senior major championships. Just outstanding. He is one of only two players who have achieved the career senior Grand Slam, winning each of the five major championships at least once during one's career. He's won two Masters titles. His first was way back in 1985, his second in 1993. He played on 10 Ryder Cup teams, was captain of the 2004 Ryder Cup. His wins and his resume could go on and on and on. And all these years later, the German is still going strong. I think you'll enjoy our conversation in which he shares the keys to his consistency over the years and his winning ways. And in the first segment, Gary McCord, former professional golfer, TV golf commentator, shares what he's been up to lately, teaming up with former CBS Sports golf commentator Peter Costas with a podcast they call Off Their Rockers. He's funny, he's irreverent, and very compelling. Hope you enjoy this edition of Sports Interview with Ann Liguori. My guest is Gary McCord, former PGA Tour pro, CBS golf commentator. You remember his role in the movie Tin Cup. And Gary and his fellow former CBS commentator Peter Costas are now hosting a podcast called Costas and McCord Off Their Rockers. So glad to have you on.
Hi, Ann. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. You know, I brought this up before the show started, but you and I co-hosted a show with Peter Jacobson called Golf 2000. That was a while ago, but we worked together. And
that was a while ago, yes.
A lot of fun. So, but I've been watching your Off Their Rockers, and it's on YouTube.com at CostasMcCord.com. And boy, what an appropriate name for a podcast that you're doing with Peter.
It was, you got to come up with a name, right? And we're sitting around, and I don't know where I saw it or something, but Betty White had a show called Off the Rockers. And I don't know if it was a TV show. I just saw it. Yeah, I saw the name and I went, Off the Rockers, because Peter and I, you know, we're a little daft. And then the fact that, you know, after 3 years of not working, we got a little bored at the back of the range. So we had two rocking chairs there. And I said, let's just get up and we'll call it Off Their Rockers and we'll go from there. So that was the deal. I stole it as I usually do. It's plagiarism with me throughout my entire career. And I kept it going in the podcast.
Well, I mean, I watched your first episode called You're Fired. You and Peter Costas, after what, 30 plus years as golf commentators on CBS Sports, were let go. And you basically were very surprised at the time. But then in this first episode of Off Their Rockers, you said CBS did me a huge favor.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, you know, you can, when you're doing golf on television, you can only define and paint the picture of a guy making a 3-footer so many times. And usually it's the first 10 minutes that you're on the air when you first started the business. Well, there he is, over 3-footer. Oh, he made it. Now for the next 33 years, you got to make that sound exciting. And after a while, as you know, it gets, you try to rewrite, you try to do things differently and come up with something because it gets stale, stagnant, and everything else. So now, after a couple of years during COVID that we were let go, we decided to do this. Just, you know, it's two old guys just trying to stay, to keep our brains going a little bit. And so we don't wander off into the abyss. Let's put it that way.
But it has to be so liberating. It has to be so liberating because you can say whatever you want. Your true personality can really come out and you don't have to worry about anything.
Yeah, I didn't realize it. As you know, if you come, like when I do podcasts with other guys during my tenure with CBS, and when you're doing things, there are so many restrictions. Like I was mandated never to talk about the Masters in any way, shape, or form. You know, 20 years after getting fired from it, I was still not allowed. And I, you know, so every word is kind of, you know, you sit there and you look at it and you feel it and should it come out? What's it going to mean? How, you know, this is in a femtosecond you're doing this. And now when I started doing the podcast, I found myself doing the same thing. Very guarded with, and I went, what the hell? This is a podcast. This is my podcast. I can say anything I want, do anything I want. And it's quite liberating. It really is. And you've been through this, through the whole thing. And it's really a lot of fun to be your own producer, director, have three other guys working, Mike Abram, myself, and Peter Costas, and kind of going any direction we want and coming up with ways to do interviews. I'm going to do, like everybody does interviews, right? You go, you know, back and forth. So I've got the boys, I'm up here at Whisper Rock, and I'm trying to get Paige Sporanic out here. All my interviews are done. We go out on the golf course, not with golf clubs, but with my metal detector. I have a metal detector. I go up in the mountains and I'm looking for gold. So I'm going to take Paige up there since she's looking for gold also. And we're going to go see if we can actually find some up here in the hills right above the golf course, which I have found a lot of weird things. But anyway, the interviews will be two people out there in the middle of nowhere trying not to get bit by rattlesnakes, coming up with some kind of banter back and forth. So, you know, stuff like that, which you could never do on network or any way, shape, or form. So you're right. I love the process.
You're going to have the time of your life, baby. I guarantee you that. You probably already are with Peter Costas. But for those of you who are too young to remember back in 94, Gary McCord was broadcasting at the Masters. You were in the 17th hole tower, and you were describing a fast putt that Jose Maria Alfable was facing. And you said...
Yeah, let me go back a little bit. as you know, when we talked about earlier, when you're doing something that is so mundane as to make a three-footer or to hit the ball in the woods, you know, all this stuff, you say, like, if the guy hit the wood or somewhere not good, you go, oh, he's dead then. Okay? So I just made a rule myself. Okay, I'm not going to use that. I'm going to do a bunch of euphemisms. I'm going to write them all down. So, you know, I said, my man, he's got a tag on his toe there. He's on the slab. He's in the morgue. He's in a body bag. What I just rewrote it. So every time I'd use another word so it wouldn't get mundane. And so I did that at Augusta. I used body bags first behind the green at 17. I said, well, you don't want to go back there. There's, you know, there's a bunch of body bags, which is the same thing as saying you're dead, which everybody says. But I got in trouble for saying body bag. I'm going, what? Just as we were talking about, right? Editing. And this particular case, I was reading a magazine between commercials. My way of doing golf was basically I had 20 magazines sitting there, and the magazines were anywhere from Scientific American to Mad Magazine, all genres across the board. I didn't really look at articles. I'd open them in commercial breaks and I'd just go through and look at words. And I mean, words, put it down and say, okay, what the hell's going to come out? And that's how I did it. In this particular time, I was reading People magazine, the 17th hole. We went to commercial break. And he had hit his ball, Jose Maria, oh, I lost my ball, had hit his ball in the wrong position in the green. And he had a putt that was similar to a long time ago to Raymond Floyd, where you really can't stop it by the hole. So I'm reading this thing on, and I spent most of my career living in Escondido, California. And Lawrence Welk's Country Club Village was right there. And next to it was a thing called the Golden Door. and it's a unbelievable resort, basically a women's resort, and fantastic, one of the best in the country. And they had a menu of all the stuff they had there. And I'm reading it real fast just before we're counting down a commercial. And it was, you know, grape leaf wraps. This was a menu, which you get grape leaf wraps, cucumber. You put cucumbers in your, right, in your, whatever that was called, seaweed wraps, bikini waxes. And as soon as I said that, I heard 3, 2, 1. They went back to, I think it was probably Nance up. No, then it was probably Pat Summerall up in the tower. And he goes, let's go to 17. And that just stuck. And it was right here. And he had this putt. And I said, the one thing these guys are afraid of on Sunday afternoon is the speed of these greens. And if you get out of position. And in fact, I don't think they mow these greens. I think they bikini wax them. And he's got a putt here, just, you know, just like that, kind of going through. And everything was okay for a couple of days, and then all hell broke loose. And then I got fired from the Masters for an extraordinary long time.
The CBS president, CBS Sports president, Neil Pilson, was sitting right next to you, right? And he was laughing.
He was right next to he was laughing, and there was the ominous thing was there was a bat phone literally right in front of me. It was red. Very intimidating. When the president of CBS Sports is sitting next to you, and that bat phone goes down into the basement of Augusta and Hort Hardin's office down there. And if Hort didn't like something, that bat phone would light up. And he would have to answer it. And then, you know, commercial break, he would tell somebody, blah, blah, blah. And it's quite intimidating. And the bat phone never lit up or anything. So I thought it was okay. But then they found out, I guess, what bikini waxes are. And that was it.
Wow, what a description. But do you think, had you said that more recently, you know, with the world kind of changing, we're a little more lenient. I know Augusta National has their rules, but do you think you would have gotten away with it, say, 5 years ago, as opposed to back in, what, 94 when you said it?
You know, we're really deeply involved, immersed, actually submerged in woke at this moment. And, well, you know, one of the reasons that, you know, I got kind of tired of it. I mean, I was talking to Barkley, too, Charles Barkley, about it. And he told me, before he got a $200 million raise, that he was going to quit at 60 because, you know, he wanted to play golf again. And he says, I can't say anything now without getting attacked from every side. And he says, I'm just tired of it. And so I guess Charles found his he found his number, because now he signed a 10-year deal. So anyway, we were talking about it, what you can and can't say and how you edit yourself prior to it. And it, you know, when I first started, you know, I had no editor. Frank Cherkinian was my editor, my producer, director, and he would just lay into me. But most of the time he wouldn't listen. He found us, all the announcers, unamusing. So I learned the hard way. But, you know, you just talked then. You just talked and, okay, you explained everything. Really didn't edit yourself. And now, man, I started probably 10 years ago starting to edit myself. I say something, they go, okay, if I say this, what's it going to mean? How are they going to interpret it? Who am I going to get yelled? But, you know, the whole deal, man, that gets frustrating after a while.
Yeah.
So the whole thing was on a kind of a slide down for me, and kind of, you know, like Faraday too. They were kind of the same, that were just kind of, we're shooting from the hip and just talking. And then all of a sudden you find all these regulations and moral restrictions and
sure.
so forth.
It's actually, it's worse now. You can't say anything.
Anything.
Good point. You cannot get away saying anything that
will
offend.
No,
anything you say is going to offend somebody at
somebody.
Some time. Right.
Yes.
So
yes.
You really have you have less freedoms now than you perhaps had when you first started your career in broadcasting.
Oh yeah, there's no question. And, you know, then thank God for YouTube, you know, where you can go on YouTube and say what you want and have who you want on and everything else. So it's a lot of fun. It's really a lot of fun.
How did you first start? How did you get connected with CBS and doing the golf and was it Frank Cherkinian that you knew, or how did you get connected in the early days?
Yeah, I was in Texas, and we were playing Colonial Country Club, playing the tournament there. And the next week was Jack Nicklaus' tournament, the Memorial, which was an invitational. And if you look at my career, I wasn't high enough on any money list to get invitations. But I was one of the three player directors on the policy board that made decisions as to the direction of the tour. which in itself is a frightening concept. And I was on an airplane. I was flying to Columbus for Jack's tournament, and all the boys from CBS were up in first class, and I was in 37C. And about halfway through the flight, there was a half-drunk bottle of wine was sent back to me from the boys up in first, right, giggling at me. So I went, I got to go say thanks. So I start walking up there during the flight. Tours on to pay. We had policy board meetings Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Okay. And I got to fly now Thursday because I'm off their bill. And I've got to go by myself to Washington, D.C., which is really expensive. And, you know, for a guy that's barely making a living, that was hard to do. So I conceived this idea. I went up to Frank. I said, hey, thanks. Frank Schirkinian, our producer, started the whole business. Thanks for the deal, blah, blah, blah. I said, Frank, let me ask you a question. And I went, blah, 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 blah. I'm on the policy board making decisions as to television contracts and so forth. What that time was ABC, ESPN, and CBS. And I said, I know nothing about television. Is there any chance I could come and sit in the trucks and watch you televise a tournament this weekend? And he goes, oh, and I said, all I need is a room. That was the whole deal. All I need is a room. So he goes, yeah, all right, check into the so forth, whatever hotel. And he says, show up on Friday for rehearsals. So I showed up on Friday for rehearsals. I got to the trucks, opened the door, sat down behind him. Somebody said, McCord's here. He goes, tell the idiot to go out to 16. And I tapped him on the shoulder. I said, Frank, I said, I want to watch how you do things to get an idea. He goes, I said, get out to 16. So I go out to the 16th hole, and I'm starting to walk back to the tee because I figured I'm a spotter. A spotter basically is somebody, a caddy that's missed the cut. They give him a headphone, so forth, so on. And then you go, Freddie Couples is hitting 7-iron, and that goes into the truck, so forth, so on. So I start to peel that way. Vern Lunt goes up in the tower, 16. He says, hey, get up here. So I turn. What? He goes, come on up. So I crawl off the tower, and he hands me a headset, and he said, Frank wants to try it as an announcer. And that was it. I got on the weekend, had no clue what I was doing. Still don't, but had no clue what I was doing. And the last shot of the day at Memorial, somebody hit it on the hill above the 16th hole. And Vern Lundquist asked me, he said, Gary, what's he got? And he was on the side of a hill, like a Bedouin goat would sit there. And the green is faster than hell going away from him. And he said, what's he got? And I said, here's what he's got. You people out there at home, I want you to go get a golf ball and get a wedge. Go out to your front lawn, chip it onto your driveway, start hollering for it to bite. And Vern started laughing. And Frank, as soon as I got done and the tournament was over, Frank goes, get up here. I need to talk to you. I went, uh-oh. So he goes, this is great. He goes, what are you doing next week? I go, I'm going to Washington, D.C., playing the tournament, which they were doing CBS. He says, great. He says, when you miss the cut, come on up to the tower again. Let's do it over again. And I went, really? That's how you do it? And I did. I missed the cut and went up in the tower. And I did that for 3 years. And CBS gave me $500 for the weekend for 3 years. Wow. Till I finally crossed my arms and go, okay, that's enough of that. I want a full-time job or I'm going to go back to playing, which wasn't much of a threat, by the way. So that's how I got the job. It was just happen chance, got lucky, you know.
That's a great story. You should tell that on Off Their Rockers.
I think we probably have. I think we've run out of stories. We've only had 4 episodes. I think we've run out all the CBS stories.
Well, I'm still trying to comprehend you looking at all these magazines during commercial breaks. You have to be the only talent in the history of network TV that can do that, because that's pretty special to be able to, you know, kind of, maybe it helps you relax or gives, as you say, gives you some ideas in your head about
words always kick something in my brain. And the one thing I didn't want to do on telecast was be repetitive, be redundant, say the same thing. So the viewers out there could literally write my script. Okay. I've seen a lot of announcers do that over a period of time. You have to have tenure to do that. And they say the same things. And that's the one thing when I started this business that I would not do. I'm a little whack. And that all that did was help me, and especially the magazines that I bought. The guy that worked for me would go by the bank magazines prior to Saturday's show. Okay. And he'd go buy them. He'd buy 10 of them, 15 of them. And I said, you buy all genres, everything. And then you'd set them down. And then I just start peeling through them doing commercial breaks. I never read one article in these magazines. I must have spent 5,000 on magazines over the years. But it was just words. It was a word. Some word kicked off something. Okay, I'm going to go that direction. Whatever. It didn't matter. It was my way. I'm not saying it's the right way. That's the way I did it, just to stay kind of fresh.
We're talking to Gary McCord, co-host with Peter Costas, Off Their Rockers on YouTube. And let's talk Masters, Gary. It was such compelling theater down the stretch. John Rahm was a warrior. I mean, the guy was in, you know, relentlessly pursuing Brooks Koepka and then playing better than Koepka in the final round. But for over 2.5 rounds, he had Koepka looking like the Koepka of old, who won four major titles in a span of like 23 months. What are your thoughts about the final round?
Well, I thought it was great. You know, you're kind of waiting. Brooks hadn't been playing good at all until he won the prior week. He's finally, you know, his knee, which was kind of gruesome, you know, his knee popped out of place and he tried to put it back and it just shattered into pieces.
I can't even picture that.
That
sounds a little weird to me,
trying to put it back. I don't know, would he hit it with a hammer? I don't know how he did that. But anyway, I guess the rehab was awful and you could see him. He couldn't bend down to get a putt, line up a putt, and he had to straighten the one leg out. So, you know, you look at that and then you look at the fact that he has been playing very many 72-hole tournaments under that spotlight, okay, on LIV, under the spotlight, which is a major. So now he's got the weight of a lot of things going. And will it crack? Is he in one tournament kind of figured it out? We all saw Full Swing on Netflix, and we all saw his segment, which I thought immediately he should seek psychiatric help after watching that, because he was in the darkness.
Absolutely.
As the pendulum swings back and forth from light to dark, that pendulum stuck on dark on his side. And wow, and we got, I thought, a really good look into the psyche of a golfer who has lost his way and now trying to figure out how to get out of that way and not doing a very good job of it. And then all of a sudden for him to win. So you start stacking this stuff up, and now he's got LIV right on his shoulders too. Because my God, if he wins that, it's going to just pop open everything on LIV. These guys are all has-beens, they're old. They're going there to get the money, you know, whatever you want to put on it. And for him to shoulder all that stuff and come back and play on the big screen was fantastic. Where he was going, I kept going, man, did he get that good again? Like he used to be that fast. And then we kind of saw it wear off. And, you know, when you stop making putts and stop getting good, but what the whole deal. And Rahm was just an animal. I mean, an animal. And for the first time I saw John gets in problems when he starts looking for cameras, starts looking for excuses. He gets pissed off, all that stuff. I never saw him once do that. He was so focused. He might get a little mad, but he didn't go through his machinations. He assumed a position of power and strength and just dove right into it and didn't let that dark side come into it. And it's just, again, it's these guys are just fighting the evils between light and dark. And it was fun to watch two guys on two ends of it.
That's
figure
right.
This whole thing out. And it was fun to watch and good golf. I wish it wasn't. The weather got a little whacked, but that's part of the whole process.
Well, it was the most watched golf telecast on any network in 5 years. It averaged 12.058 million viewers. And I just thought it was so compelling. And then you have Phil Mickelson shooting
that
the low
was
round,
unbelievable.
765. Yes. And I don't know how you stand on the LIV Tour versus PGA Tour, but wow. I mean, do you have a problem seeing these guys play so well?
No. I have no problem with them going to the direction they went because of whatever reason they have. Okay. It's a place to go. I got a little problem with them coming back and then trying to get all the benefits of the place they left, whether it be the DP tour, the European tour, or our tour, and coming back and getting pissed off that they don't get that because they chose their path to do it. And they're all friends of mine. So, you know, I see them all the time. I'm out here at a golf course in Scottsdale where there's 37 of them, tour pros here. So we see them all the time. You know, they're just one of the guys and everything. And they're just decisions. I've had long talks with a couple of them.
Phil seemed, talk about off the deep end, earlier in the week, he just seemed so sullen and very quiet and low key. And then all of a sudden, I knew he didn't want to talk to the press on Tuesday. He was invited to the interview room when all the other players were invited, but he declined. But then when he shot that, you know, that 65, he came in and just a whole different Phil, obviously. I sat on the show last week and I said, you know, the second he shoots a good score, we're going to hear from Phil. And, you know, he was right all along, Gary, when he talked last year about leverage and how the threat of a rival league would force the PGA Tour to increase prize money big time. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, in essence, they should be thanking Phil, probably most of the tours. I know the DP Tour should be thanking him because their purses increased geometrically. And PGA Tour's purses increased. Now, what the people don't really understand is all the money that was found and all going in the purses. The tour signed a contract, media contract, with the networks. And that contract took over in 2022. And that contract is for $736 million to the PGA Tour from the networks through 2030. So we got a boatload of money that started last year. So everybody goes, well, where'd they get the money? They had to hit now. This is part of the new contract. So, but it expanded. It expanded in a real quick way with $20 million tournaments that were unheard of, designated tournaments started by Rory and Tiger, and which is I find kind of funny now because they all said Tiger and Rory said, okay, we got to get this. We got to fight fire with fire. So we're going to put our best players every week against their best players every week, and we'll fight that fight. And then, of course, Tiger can't play anymore. And now Rory withdraws from a designated tournament that he came up with a fine that should be very interesting. I'm watching this one to see what the tour is going to do with a guy that designed it. And then he was the guy that, because you only skip one, okay? And he skipped the tournament champions first of the year in Kapalua. Well, now he skipped two. And you can only skip one. So what happens between one and two? What's going to happen? That's going to be interesting to watch. I don't know what question we were on, but I just deviated.
Well, we were
there
talking about the designated events. And, you know, the PGA Tour moved very quickly to combat the threat of LIV, to keep their guys from bolting to LIV. They, you know, they came up with all this dough. And now these designated tournaments are offering $20 million prize money. The players offering $25 million in prize money. And you asked the same question, where'd the money come from? And, you know, yes, the TV rights deal was incredibly wealthy, right? For the PGA Tour, billions of dollars. But, you know, a lot of the sponsors at these quote designated tournaments they're the ones that have to come up with a lot of the money. And, you know, some of the sponsors may not want to do that.
Yeah, there's going to be a shift. Because the tour now, because they've gone from the all-exempt tour where 125 guys are exempt, now they're basically, what are they, it's 60 now? I think it's 50, and then you got the add-ons. It'll be to 65 guys are exempt. So we expanded the tour, much like the Doppler shift, right? Everything is going out towards the ends of the universe, and then all of a sudden, whoops, here it comes back at us again, right? And that's the way the tour has gone. They've expanded and now they're contracting. Well, now they've set up a system where it's going to be a two-part harmony. They're going to be the haves and the have-nots. Well, it's the same way with the title sponsors. The guys that get the designated tournaments are the haves. The guys that don't are the have-nots. And the have-nots are not going to get the good fields because the haves are going to play in all the tournaments that are the big ones. So this tour has basically it's got a divide, and it's going to be interesting to see on both sides, tournament sponsors and players, how they handle that divide.
Well, I know the criticism is that it will restrict playing opportunities. You know, the PGA Tour's objective is that the top players would play each other more often. So, I mean, there's positives and negatives. A lot of these other guys don't think they'll be able to get into these designated events. What are your thoughts about, you know, about that? I mean, will it enable enough younger, newer guys to play for the big dollars?
I've gone through that because in 1983, I was the guy that did the all-exempt tour. There were 60 guys exempt on the tour, and the rest of us were qualifiers. And I think if I remember my, this is a long time ago, 68% of the tour were qualifiers at that point. And I remember sitting there, was at Doral, and I'm looking up and I counted in the qualifiers at Doral, there was Don January was there, Miller Barber qualifying, and they had won, I counted like 56 golf tournaments. These guys were there. And I went, what kind of sport is this? We got 60 guys making some kind of money. The main part of the tour is just we're getting annihilated. All we're doing is traveling from week to week to Monday to play. I said, there has to be expansion to involve these other players to be able to learn how to play instead of Mondays. You go from Monday, you shoot 71, and that's not good enough. You go the next Monday, you shoot 72. That's whatever. It wasn't enough learning process. So I just thought expansion could be the best way to do it. So let's take this now where we are now. So got expansion. I went to the players first and had a players only meeting. I said, boys, be the devil's advocate. We had 100 something guys at Tallahassee. I went up and went blah, 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 blah about this tour I thought might help us. And I said, boys, I'll take a, and I said, you ask me all these questions, be the devil's advocate. And I stood up there and I got pounded with questions. And I said, okay, show of hands, who wants me to go further with this? And they all, not all, but a vast majority said, yeah. So I called up a guy named Mike Crosswhite, who was the player liaison at that time. And I said, Mike, I got an idea for a new tour. Okay. And then Dean Beeman called me, get down here. We need to see you in Jacksonville. So I went down there. We went through this. He had a plan too. And he said, I think you're the guy that can get this done. I went, oh, that's great. I'm a qualifier. I'm a nobody. I have no voice whatsoever in anything. So I get up and I have to do two speeches in Houston in front of Arnold and Jack and Lee and the whole embodiment about taking this tour and expanding the tour and the benefits thereof. And now we're literally going the opposite direction. So what's the speech now? What is the speech now? Guys, we're going to let these guys that make a lot of money make a lot more money. And you guys are going to make good money. You're going to make good money, but it's going to be just about impossible for you guys not being able to play in designated terms to get into these things. Now, they're doing a couple little three-part harmony tournaments prior to that. I think five guys can get in the top, whatever. They're basically placating them. So I've watched the expansion. Now I'm watching the contraction. And we'll just see how it plays. That's all we can do. Sit back and you have to go power and power with Liv. If they're going to put power up front, nobody's watching at this point, CW, but we need to do the same thing. So we'll see what happens. You kind of sit back and take a look, much like the lawsuit, see what happens. But in the interim, you can see the Masters got that high rating for one reason. Liv. They all wanted to see if Koepka could handle Liv, put him on your shoulders and go win when they thought this tour is a bunch of has-beens and guys getting near 50. That's the compelling reason everybody watched. So Liv, in essence, raised purses, raised awareness, television viewers from our standpoint and the Masters, man, it accelerated the hell out of it. So I'm good for that part of it.
What does Gary McCord have to do yet that you haven't done? You've had so many incredible experiences. You've traveled the world. You've played, you've broadcasted, what haven't you done yet that you still need to do?
Well, the only thing I need to do is stay alive because that's kind of my age now at 75. You know, I'm on the 16th hole, okay, and my drives aren't going very far. So you just try to stay. I have a lot of energy, and I want to make sure that energy doesn't stop, because, you know, as I get older, you can see that if that stops, everything might stop. So this probably for Peter and I, who's the same age, is just a frenetic race to the end. And we, in the last show, will be both of us on the air, just going on a rocker, just going like that. There they go. Okay, they had a good time, and they wore each other out. So that's kind of my only goal now.
Well, it's always a pleasure to listen to you, Gary, to follow this podcast, Costas and McCord Off Their Rockers. You can see it on YouTube and their website at CostasMcCord.com. And hey, keep it going. Keep the passion up. It's all about passion and health.
That's it.
Staying healthy.
No question.
And being passionate about what you're doing, right?
And that's what you're doing well. So thank you for having me on.
Welcome back to Talking Golf with Ann Liguori, and it is my honor to welcome in the one and only, the extraordinary Bernhard Langer, who at the age of 65 years, 10 months and 5 days, became the winningest player on the PGA Tour Champions, surpassing Hale Irwin by winning a 46th title. Congratulations, Bernhard.
Thank you, Ann. I appreciate you having me on. Yes, I'm thrilled and excited of what has happened the last 15 years or so.
Well, you've won a record 12 senior major championships, and it's like fine wine. You just get better with age, right?
We all like to improve, right? And golf is one of those games where I truly believe you can still get better in your 50s and even in your 60s. You probably we'll lose a little bit of distance, maybe a little bit of strength, maybe a little bit of flexibility, but you can make up by that mentally or technically, or just work on your short game a lot and can still improve your game and your score.
So what do you think has been the key to your longevity, your consistency that has led to your winning ways?
Well, I think there's many parts of it. It's like a puzzle. The important thing is you need to be healthy, because if you're not, you can't swing or play or even participate. And then it's obviously a big thing is the desire, to still have the desire to work on your game, to go to the fitness center, work out on a daily basis, to just go out there and grind away, even though you've been doing it for 45 years. It's not always easy, but I love the game of golf. I love to compete, so it becomes second nature to me. The other thing I think is my technique has gotten better. So I hit more good shots and less what we call double crossers, left-left, right-right. I hit more fairways, more greens in regulation, which gives me more birdie putts, less chance for bogeys and double bogeys. And just having good people around you, having a great caddy, a good coach, a good manager, a family that supports you. So you can see there's a lot of pieces to the puzzle to make it all work. And it's thin air up there. You know, I always say the Champions Tour is really the only tour in the world over 50s that is worthwhile playing. There's other tours in Europe, but the prize money is so low, you can hardly make a living. And so everybody comes to America. We have the best from all over the world, the best Europeans, the best South Africans, Australians. You call it, they're going to be here if they have game. And there's only 80 guys teeing it off on a weekly basis. So that makes all 80 players actually very good, very competitive. And there's thousands in the waiting list to, you know, to get a spot or two when there's only 80 available.
Your passion is obvious. As you said, you have to have that passion, and it has to continue, you know, throughout your 50s and 60s, discipline, and your enthusiasm for the game. And the hunger to win, and as you say, to continue to work as hard as you do, that work ethic is, you've always had that.
Yeah, I've been blessed. I think I grew up with two parents who had to work extremely hard, and I grew up in that for several years watching them, and it kind of became second nature, and it was kind of drilled into me. You know, whatever you do, do it to your best capability, give it 100% or more. And so that's just was always part of my life, and it just turned into my golf game as well.
And to think that your first of two major titles, having won two Masters titles, the first one you won in 1985 was 38 years ago. Just incredible.
Yeah, it's quite amazing that it's been that long. And I'm very blessed and fortunate to have had that kind of career, because that's a hard thing to do in golf, to have longevity. It's so easy to have an injury, or, you know, to lose your confidence, to not be exempt anymore. And all of a sudden, you know, within a span of a few months, you're done, and it's difficult to fight your way back.
So how do you think your game, you know, compares now to then when you won the two Masters titles?
Well, it's interesting question, and I often thought about it. What is different, if anything? And I guess I think I won my two Masters with a persimmon driver and a steel shaft and a ballata ball. So I think through the equipment and through my improvement of maybe my technique, I think I'm a better driver of the golf ball now than I was in my 20s, 30s, and 40s. But on the other hand, I think I was always a fairly good iron player, always had good imagination and hand-eye coordination and all that kind of stuff. So that probably hasn't changed a great deal. And I may be a little bit unique in terms of putting, which is really the most important part of the game. I had years when I was maybe the best putter, and I've had years when I was the worst, and most of the years somewhere in between. And that's a difficult thing. I've had the yips four times in my life, and that was very, very tough to keep competing when you're making more putts than shots. But I think it always helped me to have that perseverance. And obviously my faith in God has helped me greatly to go through the difficult times, understanding that I am not in control, but God is in control over the whole picture. And then that it's not life and death. There's more important things in life than playing golf or playing it successfully. So I kept it in perspective most of the time, which I think helped me in the good and the bad times.
Perspective is so important. And you had mentioned the yips. How does one get over that? Obviously, if you're playing as long as you've played on your level, you're bound to perhaps experience that. But, you know, in major competitions that you play in, it has to just be devastating when you do get the yips. How do you overcome that?
Yeah, those were hard times. And, you know, there was the odd day when I questioned, should I do anything else? But I pretty much was blessed to have my faith and give it all over to God. And literally, there was one or two times in my life when I said, God, if you want me to do something else, just let me know. I'm willing to give this up. I didn't want golf to become my God and my most important thing in life. And surely he's helped me through a different putting grip, or just taking a break for a week or two, or just get away from it and put it all in perspective. He helped me to overcome it and become a pretty good putter again.
What do you have to do differently now in your mid-60s to prepare that you perhaps did not do when you won those two Masters titles?
Yeah, it's my body can't take beating hundreds and hundreds of balls anymore. So I actually practice less on the driving range. I still probably put the same amount of practice into my putting and short game. But I certainly spend more time stretching and working out, and also more time resting and recuperating to be able to have the energy, you know, for the next day.
What's your diet like?
Don't talk about it. It's not a non.
It's what?
Non-existent, my diet. I always say I'm on the seafood diet. Whatever I see, I eat. And I see a lot of dessert, so let's not go there.
So nutrition is, and diet is overrated in your book, I guess. But I understand that your mother recently turned 100 years old.
Yeah, I just actually an hour ago, I went to visit her, and she will be 100 on August 4th. So in about a week or two. And yeah, it's amazing that she's hanging in there. She always said, if I can't work anymore, I don't want to live. And she's not doing very well. She had a concussion many years ago and is bedridden, full-time care. So she hasn't worked in a number of years, but she's still hanging on and hanging in there. And yeah, I think I have her genes. So I don't know how old I'm going to get, but very blessed to have had good parents.
God bless her. That's just incredible. And she can share in your success. She must be so very, very proud of you all these years.
Well, thank you. I'm sure she was, like all parents are, you know, proud of their kids and what they do and their achievements.
So I understand you played on 10 Ryder Cup teams. That's just phenomenal, winning 5 times. And you were actually a captain of the European team in 2004 that was victorious. What are your thoughts on the Ryder Cup this year? It's coming up end of September, early October at Marco Simone in Rome, Italy. I'll be there. I'm looking forward to it. But I guess more in detail, Sergio Garcia, who's just such a great Ryder Cup player. His record's so great. I know he resigned from the DP World Tour and won't play. Is that, I guess that's true.
Yeah, I'm not quite up to date with who is allowed to play and who is not, and if it's up to the captains to pick the lift players or not. So I'm not 100% sure of the latest thing, especially with all the developments that have happened lately. But put that aside, I think it will be a thrilling match no matter what, because both continents can, you know, put a team together of 12 guys that are very compelling and great players. And I know last time the Europeans lost pretty badly. I don't think that will happen again to that extent, but I'm aware the Americans have an extremely strong team, but playing away from home always makes it harder.
And you're just so pro PGA Tour champion, setting all these records and playing, you know, having such a long career. Just your overall thoughts, Bernhard, on this proposed agreement between the PGA Tour and the Saudi PIF, Public Investment Fund.
Yeah, I think to many of us, it was like a shock when we heard the announcement because of all the statements that we heard, and each side kind of ducked their digging in and you know, throwing their arguments at the other side. I didn't see it coming, tell you the truth, not that quickly. Looking back, I wish they would have had to come to an agreement 3 years ago when they threatened with the LIV Tour and probably needed more time to think this through and work it through. And maybe nobody thought it would truly happen the way it did happen. But hopefully, in another 2 years from now, we look back and say, well, this was a good move and we can exist together or coexist or whatever. And it's better for the game of golf, because what we have right now is a lot of division and not very good.
You signed with Tour Edge Clubs in 2021. And I know my friend David Glad, the president and founder of Tour Edge, is so proud to have you represent their brand. I guess it's been a win-win, right?
Absolutely. They make a wonderful product. I'm blessed to be a part of their family, the Tour Edge family. They're a family-owned business out of Chicago, and they're trying very hard, and they're doing great. They've been around for 35 years, and they're getting better and better.
What do we, as we all age, what is your advice on what we should be doing on and off the golf course to stay young physically and mentally?
Well, I think there's two things. I think faith is extremely important. Faith in God. I'm a Christian and have been for many years now, and I know how important that has been to me and how much it has helped me on a daily basis. Secondly, I would think exercise is very important, and I don't mean it doesn't have to be strenuous or, 3 hours in the fitness center, whatever, but I think we were created to move, to use our muscles, to use our joints, and we become a sedentary nation in many ways where we sit too many hours and don't move anymore. 100 years ago, we didn't all have cars and this and that. We were walking to places, we were riding a bicycle and this and that. Nowadays, it's just too easy to sit in front of the television or in front of the computer, and we sit and sit and sit, and we don't move anymore. And many of us become obese or just don't burn the calories that we should. So my suggestion is keep moving, do something every day for several hours where you get oxygen in your body and you get the blood flowing, get the toxins out, and stay reasonably fit and healthy.
That is such good advice. And as we get older, we have to stretch and move even more, I think, to just stay fit and continually to keep your mind and body in good shape. What's in your mind now? You have more goals, obviously. What do you have to do yet that you haven't accomplished? Because I know you think about this stuff.
Not really, but I still enjoy eating and playing good golf. So the goal is, to win more tournaments. It's to maybe go to 50. Who knows? I understand it's harder and harder because the majority of the guys on the Champions Tour hit the drives longer than I do, and distance has become very important, but there's other aspects to the game where I may be better than them and make up for my lack of distance. So I still enjoy being out there. I may play a couple of tournaments less the next couple of years, but I'm still playing a full schedule. I mean, I'm playing more tournaments than Tiger Woods and Nicholas have ever played. I've played 25 tournaments a year and have done for 40 years or more. So it's time to maybe reduce it to 18 or 20. Pick the best ones and enjoy my grandkids and family.
And you're soon to be 66 years young. Well, continued success, Bernhard.
Thanks, Anne. Appreciate it.
My thanks to Bernhard Langer, to David Claude at Tour Edge Golf, to Gary McCord and his producer, Mike Abram, and to Mike Goodsell in production. Remember the words of Booker T. Washington, American educator, author, orator, and advisor to several presidents between 1890 and 1915. Booker T. Washington once said, "If you want to lift yourself up, lift up someone else." I love those words of wisdom. Have a great weekend, everybody. Be safe, be kind, and I look forward to talking to you next time right here on Sports Interview with Anne McGorry.